Mr. Derryberry, please.
May it please the court, I am Barry Derryberry, appearing for appellant Mr. Brown. This is apparently the first First Step Act that has been presented for oral argument to this court. And my argument is about the district court being able to address my client's career offender determination that had been made 12 years previously. So in presenting this issue, there is no issue, or I will say that it's apparently not contested, that my client is eligible, so eligibility is not an issue. And the other thing that I want to just tee up is the career offender issue is, I would say we would hypothetically hold that as potentially invalid. I made an argument below and in my brief that it is invalid, but that's not before this court, I don't think. I'm seeking a remand to the district court for the district court to address that issue. So what I'm looking for is the district court having the legal opportunity in addressing a motion under First Step Act to follow the prevailing sentencing law, the core sentencing law. And I refer to Gall versus United States, where the Supreme Court in 2007 said that the beginning place for a federal court in sentencing is to correctly determine the sentencing guidelines.
Well, is there anything, I understand your position, and we decided Tides, which would knock out one of the convictions that as a violent crime. Now, can you appeal the imposition of the new sentence, and under 2255 or 2254, can you still appeal or raise the issue of the calculation as a result of Tides?
So this new sentence, which is 210 months.
It's reduced.
That one. I don't see how that would be, that issue could be raised in a 2255.
Well, every case that I've been able to see says the judge can't do that, can't re-examine the background. He can do the reduction as a result of the First Step Act, period. And I'm trying to figure out a way that you could access that some and get some relief under the as a result of our Tides decision.
I take the point well, Your Honor, and I have not thought that through. I'm reacting extemporaneously now in giving you an answer, so I don't want to give a glib answer, perhaps. But I'm concerned about the. I don't actually want to stand here and describe any reason why I would not be able to prevail on a 2255. Were I to file one, I wouldn't want it to be used against me later.
Okay.
See. Okay, so I think that this, the only, to refer to what Your Honor has said about the courts that have addressed this issue that you have seen have said that door is not open into looking at this sort of issue. You know, what we really care about is what the circuits are going to say versus the cats that need to be herded in the district courts that have been all over the place. And I think that, you know, Hegwood is the one that we have, which certainly I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit, but I just want to point out we just have one circuit that has sounded on that issue so far. There's various other circuit rulings that have issued, but the vast majority of them deal with qualification for a sentence modification. So my brief just proceeds through an analysis of statutory construction. We're looking at the plain language of the statute, but one of the prime rules of statutory construction that I think we should heed while we're looking at the language of the statute is the rule we have from Merck and Company from the Supreme Court that says that courts normally assume that when Congress enacts a statute, it is aware of relevant judicial precedent. That is not recognized in Hegwood, which is, you know, first of several deficiencies I submit that are in Hegwood. And so when the First Step Act is passed, Congress is mindful of what Gall says and 3553A says, and they are essentially writing a new power of the court, the district court, to modify a sentence, and it's like a piece in the jigsaw puzzle that fits in, and Congress is aware of what the rest of the puzzle looks like. So that is where we begin, and that's why Congress, I say, intended for this to be applied in the context of Gall and 3553A. Another thing that I think is interesting to point out for the plain text analysis is use of the word imposed in Section 404B of the First Step Act. And it says that a court that imposed a sentence can impose a reduced sentence if there is a qualification that is satisfied. And so using the word imposed two times, I think, is significant, because the court that originally imposed the sentence, well, we know what that court did.
As if also.
I'm sorry.
The First Step Act also says as if, and as opposed to focusing on impose, so that if you go back and say as if, the only thing that's open is a reduction in the amount of time for the particular drug in question. Isn't that what Hegwood, for instance?
It is not allowing. So it's there are many limitations in 404B, right? So we have a limitation that says that the court may impose a reduced sentence. That says in implication it cannot increase the sentence. And 404C is entitled limitations. And so there are several limitations in there. And also by saying that it may impose the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010, I think it's sections 2 and 3, that's a second and third section, and that implies the first one does not apply. So I think the point from what you see in this statute is that Congress knows how to write these limitations.
You're giving them more credit than they're due.
They, while they're at it, why wouldn't they also say that it's limited? Maybe something like calling the Sentencing Commission to figure out what are some good limitations we should have, and then we could have something like we've had with the retroactive sentence guideline changes. But they didn't do something like that. So, that gets into another rule of construction, which is, if Congress is using this terminology, this limiting terminology, which we also see in other sentence modification, like the compassionate release has a limitation in 3582, that is, the compassionate release can only be granted if it's consistent with policy statements of the Sentencing Commission. 3582C2 is the sentence modifications based on retroactive sentencing guidelines. And so our statutes are rife with limitations, and we don't have any sort of limitation here that we would expect Congress to do what it ordinarily does. If it means for there to be a limitation, then it's going to express it. So I think another consideration is just the fact, with our hypothetically or assuming for the sake of argument, that the career offender designation is invalid. What that signifies when you have a sentence that is reimposed, if you will. And let me note, too, Hegwood at the very end says the court that is doing this business is imposing a sentence. It goes with that word. And so when you have this reimposition of a sentence that is not a legal career offender sentence anymore, so it's trickled down from the guideline that corresponds to the career offender findings, and when a sentence is reimposed under those circumstances, then it violates everything that's in the factors, sentencing factors in 3553, especially including the requirement to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities. Because down the hall, some other fellow with the same amount of crack cocaine, my client had 20 grams of crack cocaine, who's not a career offender by virtue of the 10th Circuit case on feloniously pointing a firearm in Oklahoma, that person is not going to be sentenced as a career offender. Did Congress intend that? Would Congress have intended that? And we should expect to see some sign that they would have intended something like that.
Well, if we bought into that argument, then would the fact that he's been a good guy for the last 11 years while he's been in prison give the court the right to reduce the sentence, a downward departure, because of his stellar conduct?
Well, what I am addressing is just the meat and potatoes of what happens.
Once you open up the sentence because of the word impose, you're into a plenary resentencing hearing, aren't you?
Yeah, that's what I'm not here to address, where that line may be drawn, if there is a line drawn.
Well, how should we do that? How should we draw that line?
The issue presented in this case is, may the court correct a very serious sentencing error that's in the sentencing guidelines, I should say.
So it has to be serious. So if the fact that the guy has been he's gotten his GED, he's gotten a college degree, he's gotten a master's, all while he's been in prison, the court could not take that into account, but could take into account this other situation.
I'm not purporting to draw a line. In my reply brief gets into this a little bit. There's a district court case that's called U.S. versus Washington that's cited in the government's response brief. And so the first part of my reply addresses this plenary concept. And I'm saying I don't need to argue plenary. I'm not arguing plenary. In Washington, there were issues raised such as Eighth Amendment and equal protection. And the district court is saying, and I'm not getting into all that. reopening factual disputes was also enumerated by that district judge in Washington. And though that's not related to my issue. My issue springs from the fount of the Supreme Court case that tells us in Gaul to begin all sentencings with a correct determination of the sentencing guidelines. And where
you reserve rebuttal time.
Okay,
well, I'm not forcing it. I'm just asking you because people say they want it and then they...
I usually don't say it until I'm ready to sit down. But I think I will, because there's something I anticipate I'll be wanting to reply to. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Linda Epperle. I'm an assistant United States attorney from Muskogee, here to argue for the government. Your honors, we believe that the Hedgewood case from the Fifth Circuit is the only published Tenth Circuit case, the only published circuit level case addressing this issue. The issue being whether or not under the First Step Act, you can go back and look at career offender designations that may or may not be accurate.
May or may not.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You say may or may not. We know that it's not accurate given Artides' case.
I would agree.
Okay. And so the disparity is huge if you take that into account in reimposing or imposing a sentence. How do we handle that? I mean, to me, it bothers me. Is this justice, or what is it when you say, well, even though you didn't really, we said that's not a crime of violence, we're going to pretend it was, and we're just going to give you a 20-month reduction under the First Step Act?
Actually, it is not pretending that it is all right now. It's recognizing that at the time this man was sentenced, 12 or 13 years ago, at that time, it was correct.
Well, it was not, because it was deemed to be unconstitutionally vague forever. And the fact that a lot of people, you know, made errors and nobody raised it until the individual in this particular case doesn't really remedy the situation from a fairness standpoint.
There are competing, I recognize what the judge is saying, there are competing considerations for fairness in this case, one of which is what the court mentions. And against that, you're also weighing what the Supreme Court has told us in Dillon and in other cases, that we start these analyses from a understanding that when a sentence is entered, it is supposed to be final.
Right.
And so you have finality concerns that I know this court grapples with just based on the type docket I handle these days.
Well, typically the court speaks to that in terms of reciprocity, about whether Supreme Court decisions can be applied reciprocally. And the court will tell us when it can and when it can't. Mm-hmm. But I think Judge Kelly raises a fundamental question about jurisprudence. Our role as judges, what this case does, is it presents squarely the question of these intervening facts and intervening developments that now make the sentence wrong. Now, if it hadn't come before us under the First Step Act, we'd have these kind of questions in the court. Make these issues reciprocal? Can we go back and take a look at them again? Those kind of cases, if they arose in that context, we'd say, no, we can't reconsider it. Life is tough, Jimmy Carter, quote Jimmy Carter, life is not fair. Well, the First Act, Step Act, now forces the court to go back and take a look at something that wasn't fair either, and that is the disparity in sentencing between crack and cocaine.
Yes.
And it says you should resentence, taking into consideration as if the sentence had been pronounced earlier. But in the context of doing so, should we also sentence as if we can now consider these other equitable factors? You're telling us pretty clearly, don't do that.
I'm urging this court not to do that for a couple of reasons. One, and let me, I guess, return to this quickly before I forget. The other thing that the court has to consider in this fundamental fairness and what is just, Judge Lucero just mentioned that we have another process for raising these questions. Whether they're going to be successful or not may depend on whether they're under the Armed Career Criminal Act versus career offender. But we have a 2255 habeas procedure that defendants use to raise these kind of questions. And they may be attempting to get a second and subsequent, et cetera. What would also be unfair for all of those defendants who, for whatever reason, are not able to successfully challenge a career offender designation, to go back now and grant only those defendants who were caught with crack cocaine a second bite at that apple would be fundamentally unfair. It's unfair to other drug defendants, and it's unfair to those people who were sentenced for non-drug cases. While the Congress and the Sentencing Commission, I think, have gone a long way in trying to correct that disparity between crack and powder cocaine, I do not believe that there is any sense in the law that the court meant to grant them a special gift and say, you, crack defendants, and you alone, can come back now and challenge your career offender guideline. I believe that that is why every district court, save one that I'll speak about in just a minute, every district court that I can find that has considered this question has followed Hedgewood. Now, a lot of those may not be published. They don't engage in a long analysis. They simply cite the analysis of that Fifth Circuit case, which goes through looking at the text, looking at the as-if language. We have an unpublished 11th Circuit case considering not this, but whether or not you can go back and correct for a but-for death from the drug sort of enhancement. And in that case, United States versus Carter, the court also didn't allow us to go back.
Well, could Mr. Derryberry have filed these ancillary proceedings and then consolidated them into this case before the district court? How could he have his issue addressed?
Well, he's attempted a variety of ways to get this issue addressed, and
You're saying this isn't hypothetical, Judge?
This isn't hypothetical. We have not included, out of sympathy for the court, all of the record for all of these prior 2255s, etc. But if the court considers our brief below at pages 52 to 58 of the record, there is a listing of all of those procedural things we've been through at the district court and at this court with certificates of appealability that have been denied, applications for a second subsequent 2255 to look at Johnson, denied after Beckles came down. He's filed a couple of things under the All Writs Act. He's tried a number.
Anything subsequent to the Tidies case?
That came out in 2017,
March 24th.
Yes, he, in 2018, had an All Writs Act challenge that was dismissed as an unauthorized 2255. So he's had a chance, and he should not get an extra chance that other defendants will not get if they were not crack cocaine dealers.
Well, is justice measured by the justice to others or just the justice to the particular defendant in front of the court?
That's a question that could send me thinking for about a month.
I think that'd send you to church, wouldn't it?
It would. It truly would. I think that we can best be guided by what Congress and the courts have told us, and that is that we look at the text, which here is plain. We look at the other element of statutory construction, that is that the expression of one thing excludes another. Here the court said you are to apply as if Section 2 and 3 had been in effect at the time. Congress did not intend that other changes would be made as if they, too, were in effect at the time of the offense. The only case I found, and I promise to get back to this, I want to do it before I forget, the only case that I found where under the crack cocaine, the career offender designation was allowed to be challenged, found erroneous, and relief was granted, was a case named Black. And I apologize that I do not have the site in front of me right now.
Where does it arise?
It arises, I think, from one of the district courts, but I'm not even certain of that.
Can you send a 28-J letter on
that? Yes, I would. And that was the final thing I wanted. In that case, though, where it was allowed not because of changes since that time. It was allowed because at the time the sentence was imposed, there was an error in the career offender guideline. So back in whenever, it was erroneously imposed at that time under the law at that time, and that's not what we have here. I will be happy to submit a 28-J letter with that citation, and with the court's permission, I'd also like to list district court opinions that have not been included in the briefs and maybe update the court on what the appellate status is on these other cases. I've discussed that with co-counsel. We're hoping that might be helpful to the court. If there are not further questions, I'll ask the court to affirm.
I'm not going to ask you to consider the various, under Christian theology, the various gospels that might have some relevance.
Should I find anything?
But
always
I'm sure under other religious precepts have similar concepts as well. So,
thank you.
Okay, it's a very interesting question, I agree. Thank you for ceding the rest of your time. Counsel, you have a minute and a half left.
Somebody's ready for lunch. Okay, this notion of the expression of one thing implies that there is not another thing that's intended is very, very broad and doesn't give us much.
Congress, surely, was this issue presented during the legislative history of the First Step Act? Did somebody think and say, hey, what if there are other intervening changes? Can they be considered?
I have not delved in that. When all this was new, I read all the press releases and the sponsoring congressmen and their statements about what we intend, and I've seen all of that and have not seen any inkling of that. But it's an apples and oranges thing, though, where you have Congress expressing we can retroactively apply these new sentencing ranges in the statute, and somehow that implies that following the standard sentencing apparatus in federal court is negated because it's not mentioned. They're apples and oranges. There's no reason that Congress should have naturally thought, well, we need to address what Gaul says about the law. There's no reason that it should have occurred to Congress to say anything one way or the other about that. So silence speaks to us. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Counselor excused. Thank you very much. Court is in recess until our next term. Clerk will announce the recess. Thank you.